This is Radioactive Magazine, a KKFI public affairs program of progressive activism, opinion, and commentary. Opinions expressed on this program are those of the speakers alone and are not necessarily the views of KKFI, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, show hosts, or other guests on the program.
This is Sharon Lockhart with Amy Bell, and tonight we're doing a tribute to the February Sisters from 1972 at KU, who took over a hall to fight for women's rights. And we will hear from Christine Smith and Joe Anderson about that series of events and the short life of it and what they accomplished. And this is all to honor Women's Equality Week, which is taking place this week in Kansas City. But let's start right now by introducing Christine Smith.
Hello, I'm Christine Smith.
And Joe Anderson.
Hello, glad to be here.
So what was it that got you personally involved in fighting for women's rights?
I had been working in the peace movement, both in terms of banning the bomb and justice issues, and the Vietnam War, trying to stop that awful war, and I've just got tired of the men letting us do all the work and taking all the credit and not helping with the babysitting, that sort of thing. Just, I got tired of it.
So in the peace movement itself, there was some maybe institutionalized gender discrimination.
There was institutionalized gender discrimination throughout the country. It was everywhere. It was in the university. It was in the schools. It was in churches. It was everywhere and in the movement. Eldridge Cleaver once said the place of the women in the movement is prone.
And the women that took part in February Sisters were a combination of hats. Not only were you peace activists, but you were students, you were employees at KU, you were mothers, and you had all this on top of you and no help. And so you took over a hall. What was the name of the hall you took over?
It was the East Asian Program. It was an old Victorian house that was owned by the university. I want to say a little thing about our friend C.J. Brune, who was a February sister. She was in the house, and she recently died. And she put together a list of what it was like to be a woman in 1972. And I think we have that here.
Yeah, and I'll just, this is Joe Anderson, and I'll just read a little bit from this paper that C.J. wrote. She says, the 60s was an exciting time to be part of the KU community. Intellectual curiosity and debate on controversial topics were encouraged. But KU was an open community of scholars and activists, but not so much if you were a woman. And here are some of the conditions that CJ mentions. As a female, I could expect to earn 15 to 20 cents less per hour than my male counterparts at the multitude of hourly jobs that were available at KU for students and for, you know, professional people. Also, women were offered fewer hours each week because of the fact, and not really a fact, but the supposition that it was not safe for women to walk on campus after dark. Because of this,
still true.
Because of this widespread supposition, women were the last to be considered when promotions were made. And back then, there was no affirmative action office. So your complaints just went nowhere. There were limited options for child care. The university offered none, despite the fact that there were increasing numbers of women with children in the student body. Now, only about 3 or 4 daycares were available at that time, but they were off campus, and a lot of times women students didn't have transportation. So there weren't any role models. You know, most of the administrators and professors were men. By 1970, there was a Black Studies department, but there really wasn't anything at KU for women's studies. One of the worst parts at KU at the time was that you could expect no form of health care specifically for women at the Student Health Center. No birth control pills, no contraception, no pelvic exams, no pap smears, and the doctors wouldn't even discuss this. You couldn't even get birth control pills or any kind of devices, even if you were married. So a lot of us, you know, turned to radical feminism as a realistic and viable alternative.
You know, now in the KU Health Center, they have a little candy bowl full of condoms right at the door.
Yeah.
Excellent. They learned something.
Now, if only it were that easy for women to get contraception. KU, it sounds like, has changed in a lot of ways. And a lot of the things that you fought for have really improved the situation for women, as personally, I'm a student at KU with a child, and my child attends the child care center that they now have on campus. It's a very good child care center. It's actually getting hard for people to get into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been to their health services, and it's a fully comprehensive health services place. I see women working in pretty equal numbers at the student employment. I have friends who are grad students and faculty, and they it's mixed.
Sure.
It's mixed, and there are still a lot of professions that are very hostile towards women on the KU campus.
There's no pay parity either. Women are still making less per hour.
So with you here, and I really like the stories of how all of this was accomplished, but I also want to know what you think we need to do better. What do we need to be doing? How do we have a movement that gets their attention today?
Well, I'd like to back up a little bit, because the February Sisters were very successful by this taking over this building. I mean, the reason they chose the East Asian Studies Department was because somebody had a key. A sympathetic person had a key. You know, and women went in small groups, two or three at a time. And they went in and occupied the building kind of under the radar screen. And it's this kind of affirmative action or civil disobedience, if you want to call it, that gets people's attention. But the February Sisters had six demands. First of all, they demanded an affirmative action program, but the university had already set this up a few hours before they went into the house. So this idea had already been floated. It was done. Okay, they demanded a free daycare center financed by the university, and of course what came from that was Hilltop. Now Hilltop always
is not free.
It's not free. It's never been free. It is subsidized by Student Senate funds, and it's on a sliding scale. And you mentioned the waiting list. When it first opened, there were, if memory serves me right, 36 slots and a waiting list. So it's always had a waiting list and been a wonderful service. The third demand was that a woman be designated to fill the vacated position of Vice Chancellor of Academic Affairs. Now, it took 6 years for that to happen, but one of the February Sisters was put on the search committee, and after that, the search committees pretty much all had women. Frances Horowitz was hired in 1978. She was terrific. Now, demand number four had to do with pay equity. That's still a little squishy. Number five was a demand that there be a Department of Women's Studies to be controlled and chiefly taught by women. The first Women's Studies course then was in the fall of 1972, the first full semester after the occupation of the house. By 1973, there was an organized program called Women's Studies. And then demand number six was a women's health program at the student hospital. And it wasn't until the administrator, who was kind of in charge of everything, died that demand was met. So,
how long did that take for him to die?
A couple of years.
Yeah, 1974. He was pretty old.
Was he? Was he going to relinquish his authority very easily?
Absolutely not. And now, and nobody was going to question him.
Right, right. Yeah. Sort of an emeritus position or high honor.
Yeah.
Well, and Joe, you were the designated babysitter, I understand.
Yes.
While you were also an employee and you were working on your graduate program, too, at the university.
I was a student in American Studies, and I was head teacher and director of one of the other daycare facilities in Lawrence. I wasn't involved in the committee, you know, after, who was it, Robin?
Robin Morgan.
After Robin Morgan spoke. I did go to hear her, but I didn't join the group. But one of the members of the group, Molly Cooley, called me and said, we need a designated babysitter. And we'd like that to be you, because, you know, I had a lot of experience with taking care of kids. And I totally agreed. And she said, we don't know how long we'll be in the house. It could be as long as 2 weeks. And and you may have up to 20 kids to take care of.
Oh, my.
Which I was fine with that. That was okay.
So how many women occupied the house?
There were 30 women there. However, history has said 20. It was in the paper right after the event that there were 20. It's 20 on the historical marker. But Mary Coral, another sister who has passed away, said, we counted, there were 30, and I believe her.
Now, tell us about the Robin Morgan talk that brought this up. And as you said earlier, you were the first women anywhere in the country to ever stand up for women's rights, for women's civil rights.
To occupy
property. Occupy a building. I'm sorry, to occupy a building.
Yes. There were those ladies that chained themselves to the White House fence.
Right.
Robin came to town speaking with Minority Opinions Forum. Minority Opinions Forum brought the head of the Nazi Party, and it was truly a minority opinion forum. And Robin came as a radical feminist. I don't remember much of her speech. I remember that it was very full, and it was in the union where you can open doors and make the rooms bigger, and they just kept opening doors and adding more chairs. And so there was a big crowd. We had been with her at the potluck earlier, so we were sitting up front because we came in with her. I don't remember a lot of the speech. I don't remember really the reactions. I don't remember people being hostile or anything. But afterwards, there was a reception, I believe, given by the Dean of Women's Office, which is odd because they weren't generally into that sort of thing. But there were cookies and punch and Robin Morgan and no men. I don't know who was not letting the men in. I didn't see that person, but there were no men at the reception. And women again went through. We've been working for years trying to get health care. We've been talking to the chancellor. We've done this. The stories, and there were more and more women. There were a couple of hundred women there, I think, at that point.
Oh, I don't know.
And they were getting madder and madder and madder. And at midnight, the people from the union came and said, you have to go home. It's midnight. We're closing down. But they went, in fact, across the street to where there were a lot of student offices, and in the building that, in fact, was the first home of Hilltop. And those people met. I took my children and went home at that point. But there were committees that found the place. There were committees that got enough food for up to 50 women for up to 2 weeks. There were people that did security and communications, and how are we going to talk to them, and what if they cut off the phones and that sort of thing. There were people writing the demands and the press releases to say that we were there. So there were I think hundreds of women working from Wednesday night at midnight until Friday evening. Friday afternoon was when I got the call and said, people are occupying a building.
Tonight, do you
and your kids want to come? And I said yes.
So the kids went with you and occupied the building?
Well, some. I had my children, my daughter, who is two, nearly three, and my son, who is six. But you had kids.
I had kids at my house. I had, of course, my daughter and four other children. Somewhere along the line, I can't remember, it was dark. Somebody brought by a baby. I guess the baby had been at the house and then decided that she needed to leave. So I had a baby, which was delightful, but only for less than an hour, because then somebody came and picked her up, took her away. I didn't want to let go of her, but, you know.
And there were two other children in the house, Kevin Babbitt. No, there was one other child in the house, Kevin Babbitt. The baby was there and left in the middle of the night.
Right.
So the logistics of this were astounding, that you pulled mm-hmm. that together in almost, like a day and a half.
Yep. Lots of support people. Lots and lots of support people.
So how long did you ultimately wind up occupying the house?
For 13 hours. We went in after dark. It was February, so it got dark pretty early. I have no idea what time we went in.
So did you at least eat some of the food that all those people
ate? Oh, yes. Yes, we did. My son, who several years later said, "Do you remember the night we stole that house?" and he remembered the food. He remembered a whole room full of food. That was one of his memories. Once we all gathered there, they called the chancellor, some lady, some February sister somewhere, called the chancellor and said, "Women have taken over this house." And he didn't believe it and hung up, but she had to call him back. But they finally, they began putting out things to people who were out on campus on Friday night saying, "Women are occupying this building." And the chancellor did eventually believe it and got together the university faculty senate executive committee. Cinex was it? I'm not exactly sure now what it stood for. And so they were meeting, and around midnight or so, I think, they said, "Well, does somebody want to come over and talk to Cinex about what you want?" The demands were out. They were part of what was being handed out to people. And so we got a couple of women from the house, and there were a couple of women who weren't in the house, so they wouldn't know. And they went over and met with Cinex. And they came back in an hour or so and said, "Well, they're saying the same stuff. Just, gee, we didn't know this was a problem. Gee, nobody ever asked for this before." And it's like, no, not true. We're all here in the same room, and we know that this is not true. And I said to the negotiating team, "When you go back, remind them that we are not just students in here. There are faculty wives and workers. They're staff here, and they're not going to go away in 4 years. They're going to remember." Because you can tell students you'll do something about it next year, and pretty soon they're gone. So they said, "Well, you go back with the team when they go back to Cinex." And so I was on that second negotiating team that met with Cinex. By this time, it must have been 3 or 4 in the morning. I don't remember looking at any clocks. There were a lot of, once people found out we were there, there were people at windows, there were people on on guys came to the door and said, there's snakes in the building. You have to let us in. There's snakes in the building.
Was that under the assumption that women would just go, snakes?
Yes, ah! I think so. I think they expected us, I'm sure, to run out in our underwear. I'm sure that's what the hope was. and there was a professor that came just nearly in tears, afraid for his work that he had left on his desk. And people assured him that it was perfectly all right and nobody was messing anything up. And in fact, it wasn't. Nothing was messed up. When I gave my little speech, we're not just students here. We're faculty wives. Of course, Cinex was all male. And there was this moment, it was palpable, when every man was saying, do I know where my wife is? it was really a delightful moment, although not altogether pleasant. And eventually then, the Cinex decided they could do several things. They got the daycare center stuff on the Student Senate agenda for the next Monday. They did, or maybe Sunday night, they put women on search committees. There was a lot that they could do even in the middle of the night. And they said, an agreement was struck. And we did pretty well except for the health care that we had to wait for that guy.
The 2-year wait.
Right.
For him to roll over, yeah.
They really wanted us to get out of the building before daylight because they didn't want the media to take pictures of us coming out of the building. And that was, we had that as something we could use against them. Well, you need to get some stuff done then if you want us out that soon. And it was a catalyst to them. And a useful tool that we used later in other actions on campus.
So was anybody arrested or was there any sort of action? They just kind of...
No. No one was fired. No one was suspended from school. No one, as far as I know, they never got a list of who was there. We only used first names. We were a little paranoid.
For good reason. I think there's a lot of, there could have been a lot of backlash to individuals from that. And that's kind of what makes it so hard to organize.
I don't know. Well, we had all those organizing skills from years of fighting the Vietnam War. We knew how to do it.
And civil rights.
Mm-hmm. And civil rights. We knew how to do it. It was just a matter of getting rid of those men and doing it.
And so now at KU, your Senate Executive Committee is comprised of equal parts of women, or are you aware?
I don't know.
And maybe that's something Amy can research and report on every woman at a later date.
Well, I do know that right now that there was recent women uprising at KU over campus rape.
Right.
And specifically the handling of campus rape. And that women are not believed, and that women are basically told that the rape was their fault, and they're just not doing enough to protect their students. Right. And it's almost like they're really confused about it. Like, they really don't understand the concept of it's the men that did the raping. Not the woman who got raped.
Right.
And they're trying to help them with that. And actually, KU went overboard. Apparently, they got in trouble for being overly protective of a woman who had a kind of aggressive male partner. And so now they're having to try to find this balance.
One of the things that stands out, not only for the February Sisters, but for all movements of this kind, is when a group of people get together and formulate their demands. So if the women can come up with steps that can be taken to ameliorate this problem or to solve this problem, and then you present the demands. The people, let's call them the people in charge, okay? I mean, we're all in charge. But let's say the people in charge of this policing the campus. They're just people. They need guidance. They need someone to set out the steps that can be taken. And if you want to call yourself victims, you can. But once you take power, you're not victims anymore. You're in the driver's seat. And it's important to state your goals.
And that is a hard, I think that's the hard transition.
Of course.
Is that when they think of somebody as a victim, and then when a victim takes charge and doesn't look like a victim anymore, they forget that they still need help.
Well, that's where you come up with your demands. Here's how you can solve this problem. Step one, step two, step three. There. Now you have it. Now do it for us.
I'm going to go back to the February Sisters a minute. The daycare center opened that very fall at Hilltop. And the only reason why it could do that was because there were women who had spent 2 or 3 years looking up all the regulations, all the laws, all what you needed to do, so that they knew, so that when the opportunity came, they knew how.
Right.
And I think that kind of homework is important. It's the way we can take over, the way we can manage our lives is by knowing how to manage our lives.
So instead of saying, you guys need to figure this out for us,
right,
you figure it out and say, you need to let us put our plan in action.
Yes.
Right. Or you can tell them, you need to take these steps, and we'll tell you how to do it.
We are absolutely have maxed out our time here today.
Oh, thank you so much, Joe Anderson and Christine Smith, for coming in from Lawrence and sharing about the February Sisters action on the KU campus in 1972. And I know you can Google it and find out more. And since then, I understand there's a September Sisters. We'll have to charge Amy with finding the September Sisters and reporting to us on what their actions are.
And I'd like to see some pictures of this stuff, if any of you have any.
Oh, she just happens to. Too bad we aren't television.
Well, we have Facebook, so we'll try to get some of that up online and give you a look into what activism looked like.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
You have been listening to Radioactive Magazine, a locally produced broadcast spotlighting social and political activists in our community. If you'd like more information or like to comment on this program, call Bill Claus at 816-994-7869.